his illness, sort of, there were, what, about three iterations of it?
Yes, well, four. He had Hodgkin's disease when he was in his early 30s, and he had massive radiation for that, which came back then three times. He had very severe heart disease, and then he had Burkitt's lymphoma, and then he ended up dying from lung cancer.
Some people would feel bitter because the treatment that saved them the first time is what's going to kill them. But he did not see it that way.
He didn't see it that way. He never saw it that way. He felt that the 30 years that he had were, as he put it, a secular miracle. He felt that science had saved him, that good doctors had saved him, and that he had no call to be alive. He didn't have a molecule of entitlement in him, which I think made life and death easier for him. And he was very philosophical about it. Took astonishing degree. I certainly couldn't be that philosophical. I wasn't bitter, and I don't think either of us was bitter or angry about it. We both felt like we were very lucky in life that we had, you know, access to really good doctors and people who really cared about him and so forth. So it was hard to get bitter, but I know what you say because a lot of people do, but he didn't. He felt 30 years was 30 years.
I'm trying to figure out where to start with this love story.
Any place. I think that, you know, one of the things I really wanted to do, I'd read a few books about grief and at some point, and I was struck by the fact they didn't talk so much about the person who died as about grief itself. And I really wanted to me, you can't talk about grief without really describing who it is that died in a way. And I very much wanted it to be an elegy, and I very much wanted to have some sense of the joie de vivre. And the life, and also the life of the mind of a scientist and a doctor, because I think people tend to write beautifully about poets and writers and even politicians, strangely enough. But they don't write so much about how interesting doctors and scientists can be. And most of my colleagues are really very interesting, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, exuberant people. And so I wanted to make that clear.
And Richard was very funny.
Very dry, very dry. And I find that the thing that I miss most now is when something particularly absurd goes on in our profession, which happens not infrequently, and I want to run home to Richard and say, you are not going to believe this, you know, because he would be droll or just have a one-liner that would pulverize both of us, and that's something one misses a lot.
He dies not quite the middle of the book, but about two-thirds of the way through.
Right.
I grieved, too, which is silly, because I just picked the book up and I didn't know anything about him until then. But by the time I got to that point, I was like, oh, no, not yet. Couldn't that be just later in the book? It was hard dealing with dealing with his absence. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that's the whole point, is that, you know, is that grief hits everyone, and, you know, unless, you know, you're completely isolated, it hits everyone. And if you're lucky enough to love, it's going to hit. And so, there's very little preparation for grief. I was struck by that. I mean, I thought I'd been around a fair amount, and I think it's so particular to the person you miss, and yet it's such a universal experience. And I had been aware of the saving grace of grief. I mean, I think there's very little saving grace about depression, and I knew depression very, very well. And I guess I thought that same would be true for grief. And in fact, grief serves a very real sustaining function in one's life that I ended up being remarkably in awe of. But still, there's no preparation.
I found that, this is going to sound weird, lifelong depressive. I found that I liked grief a lot better than I liked depression.
Yeah.
Because at least grief had a point.
It's a point, and you're alive. You feel alive. I mean, with depression, one of the many horrible things about depression is you're dead. I mean, you're dead to everything that you value in yourself and in life. And if you're alive in depression, you're only alive enough to be agitated or paranoid or irritable, you know. So there's nothing life-saving. Whereas in grief, you're frequently in the fray of life. You're involved. If anything, you feel much more intensely involved with life, an intense, acute missing, but an acute awareness of life as well. So it's a very, very different state. I think people confuse them, but they're very, very different. I mean, give me grief any day of the week. And that's a terrible thing to say, because at least with depression, once you're over it, you know, the other person isn't dead in your life. I mean, once you go through grief, the person is still gone. I mean, you can't go around it. You can't subvert it. You really have to be subjected to these waves, and you don't know when they're coming, and you don't know what the memories are going to be. You don't know whether the memories are going to be good or bad or conflicted. You don't know what's going to come your way. And by the time you come out of that, you come out of it, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but genuinely stronger, and with a much better understanding of the person you lost, and a much better understanding of yourself, of your vulnerabilities, of your strengths, of what it is that you were missing, what it is you'll never find in anybody else again, probably, and those things that you probably will find in somebody else again. I mean, if grief forces you to do really the kind of introspection that is really remarkable, I think. Not the kind of introspection you'd sign up for, but given that you have to go through it.
The book is Nothing Was the Same, a memoir. I've been speaking with the author, Kay Redfield Jamison, and Nothing Was the Same, published by Knopf.